14, text number 31, how Krishna explains to the system. Shri Uddhava Uvacha Yathatvam Aravindaksha Yadisham Vayat Atmakam Dhyayan Mukshuait Dhyayan Mukshutanne Dhyanam Cham Vaktamarhasi Shiva Vacha Yatatra Maravindaksha Yadisham Vayat Atmakam Dhyan Mukshuitanme Yanam Tvam Vaktamarhasi Shri Uddhava Uvacha Yatatvam Agadindaksha Yadisham Vayat Atmakam Dhyan Mukshuitanme Yanam Tvam Vaktamarhasi Shri Uddhava Vacha Shri Uddhava said, Yatha, in what way, Tvam, you, Aravinda Aksha, O my dear lotus-eyed Krishna, Yadisham, of what specific nature, Va, or, Yat Atmakam, in what specific form? Yaya Yet, should meditate, Mumukshu, one who desires liberation, Itat, this, May, to me, Dhyanam, meditation, Tvam, you. Vaktum, to speak or explain. Shri Uddhava said, sorry, translation and purport by the disciples of Shri Prabhupada. Shri Uddhava said, my dear lotus-eyed Krishna, by what process should one who desires liberation meditate upon you? Of what specific nature should this meditation be? And upon which form should he meditate? Kindly explain to me this topic of meditation. Perfect. It has already been elaborately explained by the Supreme Lord that without loving devotional service rendered to him and the association of devotees, no other process of self-realization will work. Therefore, it may be asked, why Uddhava is again referring to the system of meditation, dhyana, the acharyas explain that one cannot fully appreciate the beauty and perfection of bhakti yoga unless one sees its superiority to all other processes. Through comparative analysis, the devotees become fully ecstatic in their appreciation of bhakti yoga. It should also be understood that although Uddhava asks about those who aspire for liberation, he is not actually a mumukshu, a salvationist. Rather, he is asking questions for the benefit of those who are not on the platform of love of Godhead. Uddhava wants to hear this knowledge for his personal appreciation and so that those who pursue salvation or liberation can be protected and redirected to the path of pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Translation again. Shri Uddhava said, my dear lotus-eyed Krishna, by what process should one who desires liberation meditate upon you? Of what specific nature should this meditation be? And upon which form should he meditate? Kindly explain to me this topic of meditation. Amagyana Kinanasvakanam Janashlakya Shakshunmitam Yenatasmai Shri Gurenma Shai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Garada Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinanda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Okay. So, the chapter is entitled Lord Krishna Explains the Yoga System. And previously, as stated in the purport, it's already been explained that Bhakti Yoga is the topmost yoga system. So, Uddhava asked for the further the explanation on the dhyana meditation process for two reasons. You have to have the beauty, perfection and superiority of bhakti explained so that we can fully appreciate the process of bhakti yoga. And in the purpose in sit and become ecstatic in that appreciation. And the other reason is that the salvationists who are not properly directed on the path of liberation are getting redirected to the path of bhakti by understanding its superiority and are able to therefore pursue that same path. So Uddhava is he refers in that verse to the liberation process, which a bhakti yogi is usually not interested in. I'm going to talk about that later. So the dhyana yoga process, it's the path of the Astanga yoga process. Dhyana is the sixth or the seventh limb of the Astanga yoga process, which means eight limbs. So it accumulates in samadhi. I'm just going to give a quick explanation because these days we have a lot of yogis who, so-called yogis who approach Krishna. So the eight limbs of Astanga yoga start from yama, which are the do's. Shortly explained, it's a code of conduct or a self-restraint. And niyama these are the don'ts. And the niyama is the religious observance and commitment to practice of study of the scriptures and actually devotional activities. But in this sense, devotion is misunderstood because devotion is only practiced for, so-called devotion is only practiced for so long as one is not one with the Supreme Lord or becomes merged in him, what the goal would be. Then the third limb of the Astanga yoga system are the asanas. So the asanas are basically meant to integrate the mind and the body through physical practices. What is very interesting these days is that people like these asanas, but they don't like the yamas and niyamas. So they don't want to commit to actually get the real benefit of the asanas. Then there's pranayama process, which is the regulation of breath, and the pratyahara, which is the withdrawal of the senses, and the dharana, which is like a strong concentration. The dhyana is the meditation, and the samadhi is that state which is explained as super consciousness. So it's going to go a bit slower through it. So yama actually is a very interesting thing because it includes many of the things we do as well. Basically, a person who is following the Astanga yoga process and is following the yamas, he's celibate, he's non-violent, which obviously includes being vegetarian, and he is truthful. So basically, the person who is following the yama is following the four regulated principles. That's basically what the yamas are. And the niyama is explained as following five principles. This is chocha, internal and external purity, the santosha, contentment, tapas, everyone knows what tapas is, you all like it very much, it's austerities, svadhyana, study of religious books, and chanting of mantras, and the isvara pranidhana, the self-surrender, that's very interesting, the self-surrender to God and his worship. And so the niyama is in that sense different from yama because it refers to mental exercises to control the body and our emotional body as well. So these things are obviously you know, things like the self-surrender to God and His worship, it's not a very deep understanding of it, because first of all, it's in the second stage of the Astanga process. And the second thing is also that people have not the correct understanding of God. But there's very positive things like, you know, purity, study of scriptures, and all these kind of things. And the asanas are the physical exercises. Asana basically means to sit. So it's like a sitting postures. And there's two main classes of asanas. And this is the yoga vyayam. This is the dynamic, it's more like a flow. It's a dynamic exercise. And the asanas which are being held, and which are based on basically just breathing and like clearing the mind. And there's physical advantages, and it is supposed to improve the ability of the mind, the focus of the mind, the concentration of the mind. And that's what a lot of people who come to do yoga, for example, at Urban Yoga, that is the first thing they really notice, that their mind becomes less disturbed. So that's the benefit of the asana. And it is supposed to clarify and clear out the consciousness. So then we have the pranayama, which is, prana means life energy and yama means to control. So it controls the breath. And the breathing is a medium to achieve basically a higher state of awareness. And it's said that the mind and the life force are correlated to our breath. If we look at medical science, it's quite interesting because, you know, we hear about yogis who've been living for 500 years in the Himalayas, and or like people who stop breathing, they can live for such a long period of time. And in science, we found out that it's not necessarily the years of our life which are limiting to our life, but it's the oxygen. The oxygen we're breathing in gives us life, because if we would stop breathing now, you know, probably most of us will die. And at the same time, oxygen is that which makes the body deteriorate. So that which gives us life ultimately destroys our life. So the pranayama, they are able to go into these very subtle airs and basically stop breathing. We hear about yogis like sitting for 10,000 years, and Sarabhi Muni, for example, is an example, or the Prachetas, sitting for many thousands of years under the water. And they, under the water, I'm sure everyone tried it, but it's very difficult to breathe, and you get a lot of water in your lungs. So they stop breathing. And also in the next couple of verses, Krishna is going more into this Astanga process, and he explains about the pranayama, and he speaks about in the verse 32-33 about purak, rechak, and kubak, which is inhalation, exhalation, and holding of the breath. So he's even referring in the verse about that. So it was interesting to find. Yeah, and the pranayama ultimately is supposed to purify the nadis. Many people heard about the nadis, it's kind of a common thing. The nadis are the energy channels in our body. And for example, it's often connected, like this is like, as far as I understand, like, you know, correlates with the acupuncture points in the Chinese medicine as well. And ultimately, pranayama is supposed to awaken the kundalini shakti, which is also a common thing. So kundalini shakti is something like a cosmic energy which is called up in the base of the spine, and through that pranayama they raise it up to the muladhara chakra, which is the crown chakra, and want to like attain like a cosmic awareness of it, like a super consciousness basically in that sense. It's one path of self-realization for the yogis. Okay, so the next stage is the pratyahara, which brings the awareness, which withdraws the awareness from the external world, and like which disconnects the senses basically from the external world and brings the consciousness within. And obviously, like each one of them is based on the previous processes. You can't just jump to Pratyahara if this is what the Ashtanga Yoga system says. If you haven't practiced the previous ones, for example, you can't practice asanas if you haven't gotten the yamas and niyamas right. So it's a greater process. And then we come to dharana, which is a concentration, like a very strong form of concentration, which basically merges into the dhyana process, which comes to that, which comes to the meditation. The concentration develops to become the meditation process. And obviously there's, so it's explained that for this concentration process, as we have in the Bhagavad Gita, you focus on the tip of the nose or between the eyebrows, and you don't let your mind get distracted from anything else. Not from somebody who walks by or has like a radio playing loudly, or from the things you would like to do or the things you didn't want to do. And yeah, the dhyana process. And this stage, actually, it's very interesting because this stage, this like a mundane definition, becomes very swampy. That you can see that it becomes very kind of airy-fairy. And they use words like, meditation on, like, which is basically comes to samadhi, meditation on the om with bhava and removes obstacles. It becomes very swampy. You can see there's no clear definition anymore of it. In that mundane understanding you can usually get from the internet. So at this point, I just pull back to the Srimad Bhagavatam, where we get to samadhi. So the following verses describe this Ashtanga Yoga process. And as we all read, the verse is asking, by what process should one who desires liberation meditate upon you? Of what specific nature should this meditation be? And upon which form should be meditated? Kindly explain to this to me. Kindly explain to me this topic of meditation. So in a later chapter, in the 47th, Krishna explains. He answers that very question which was just posed. He says, keeping the eyes half closed and fixed on the tip of one's nose, being enlivened and alert, one should meditate on the lotus flower situated within the heart. This lotus has 8 petals and is situated on an erect lotus stalk. One should meditate on the sun, moon and fire, placing them one after another within the whirl of that lotus flower. Placing my transcendental form within the fire, one should meditate upon it as his auspicious goal of meditation. That form is perfectly proportioned, gentle and cheerful. It possesses 4 beautiful long arms, a charming beautiful neck, a handsome forehead, a pure smile and glowing shark-shaped earrings suspended from 2 identical ears. That spiritual form is the color of a dark rain cloud and is garbed in golden yellowish silk. The chest of that form is the abode of Shivas and the goddess of fortune. And that form is also decorated with a conchal disc, club, lotus flower and garland of forest flowers. The 2 brilliant lotus feet are decorated as ankle bells and bracelets, and the form exhibits a Kasturba gem along with an effulgent crown. The upper hips are beautiful. I think the mic just went off. The upper hips are beautified by a golden belt, and the arms are decorated with valuable bracelets. All of the limbs of that beautiful form capture the heart, and the face is beautified by merciful glancing. Pulling the senses back from the sense objects, one should be grave and self-controlled and should use the intelligence to strongly fix the mind upon all of the limbs of my transcendental body. Thus one should meditate upon that most delicate transcendental form of mine. So this is where the Ashtanga process, the dhyana yoga process should lead us to, as the form of the Paramatma situated in the heart. And this is the verse, this will answer that question which is just in this verse been posed by Uddhava. And so he answers the correct procedure, nature and object of meditation for those desiring liberation. So for this process, I had a look in the Chaitanya Charitamrita and the Madhya Lila, and it was explained again very elaborately how Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga, the other yoga processes, are absolutely useless without any bhakti. So this realization of the Paramatma is not possible without any bhakti in these processes. It's impossible to attain the desired result. And there's a quote in the Madhya 22nd chapter 8 in verse, without devotional service, all other methods of spiritual realization are weak and insignificant. Unless one comes to the devotional service of Lord Krishna, jnana and yoga cannot give the desired result. So the desired result is to come to the ultimate goal, which is to understand Krishna. This is the goal of all yoga processes. And whichever path you follow, you should ultimately come to the realization of Krishna, otherwise you don't go anywhere. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first chapter, in the second verse, first canto, second chapter, sixth verse, it's explained that the supreme occupation is by which we can attain loving devotion service unto the Lord. And it says also it should be completely unmotivated and uninterrupted. And only in this way we can actually find lasting satisfaction. The ananda aspect comes with realization of Bhagavan. Jnana gives knowledge, and yoga gives eternity, but only bhakti yoga can give that bliss which actually is able to fix us in our position. If you don't have the bliss, we can't last in it, and we might not even go in close to it. So and also we can't, when we follow bhakti yoga, we automatically achieve all these other things with losing interest in the external world. Another aspect of it is that the other processes are very, very troublesome. They're involving severe austerities. Nobody likes severe austerities, isn't it? We do austerities, like you can see in the mundane world, people do quite severe austerities, but there's always the desire for sense gratification at the end. But severe austerities and not getting anything in return, that's first of all, that's from the very beginning very troublesome, and it's not maintainable. So these other yoga processes, their practice is very prolonged and it's very intense, and there's no guarantee of success. We can see great sages like Vishwamitra Muni. He was so severely practicing his austerity and his meditation, and Menaka broke his meditation like that. Jesus did some little bit of ringing with the belts, with the bracelets, and straight away he fell. Even though so intensely he's been practicing. I mean, who in this day and age has the power of Vishwamitra Muni? I personally haven't met anybody. Yeah, well, beside of devotees. But it is the result is very uncertain, and the path is extremely troublesome. You know, if you don't have the desire for sense gratification, we can't renounce. Who would give anything up or do anything if there's no sense gratification? We have to really look at ourselves. For example, Srila Prabhupada said that the main driving force in material life is sex pleasure. You would see people do so much for getting sexual satisfaction. They're working so hard. People do so many intense things because there's a hope for sense gratification. But if you take away that reward in the end, that desired result they are having for satisfying their senses, they're not going to do it. That's one of the reasons maybe it's difficult to work in a volunteer movement as a Hare Krishna movement, because it's we don't pay people usually. So if you take away money, for example, the motivation has to come from within. So it's based on our bhakti. So you can see that people us as conditioned souls, we are very much focused on getting rewards for our activities, and then we can tolerate austerities. But without having that, it's very difficult. So this is the path of the yogi and of the jnani. It's very, very difficult to renounce without having really anything as a reward for sense gratification. So it also has to be quite a big frustration in the life to be able to do that. As well, determination and intelligence and discrimination were polluted apparently because they don't approach Krishna directly. So bhakti yoga is necessary in any path to actually bring real success, because we will get rewards according to our yogi performance or austerities in the degree that it's like bhakti yoga is like an accelerator, or like it's actually like you know, the raising agent. You know, if you don't put the yeast in the dough, it will not raise. So bhakti is that very thing which makes the yoga processes going and happening. And there's a quote in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 14th chapter 4. My dear Lord, devotional service unto you is the only auspicious path. If one gives up simply for mental speculation or the understanding that these living beings are spirit souls and the material world is false, he is understood as a great deal of trouble. He only gains troublesome and inauspicious activities. His endeavors are like beating a husk that is already devoid of rice. His labor becomes fruitless. Another example in that connection is Vyasadeva, who got severely chastised by a spiritual master Narada Muni because he was explaining so much about Karmakanda, yoga, the Yoga Sutras, and like in the Vedas. But he hasn't elaborated on devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So Narada Muni himself tells him that any of these processes are devoid of beauty, are devoid of knowledge, and it's materially contaminated if there's no bhakti involved. And he also is saying that there, and this is in the first canto, in the fifth chapter, also said that they are naturally very painful from the beginning and transient by nature. So they have to gain the attractiveness, to gain the fruitfulness, they have to be saturated with bhakti yoga, any of these processes. Another verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second chapter of the fourth chapter, is that everyone who might give all their possessions away in charity and who performs very auspicious activities and who performs all this, you know, meditation and jnana yoga, mental speculation, is not able to attain any auspicious result, although they engage in auspicious activities, if they do not dedicate the activities to the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we can clearly see, like through all these quotes, and that we don't achieve anything if we don't involve bhakti yoga in our activities, and obviously we achieve the most if we solely rely on bhakti yoga. Because the bhakti yoga itself is so powerful that all other yoga processes are automatically included. So we can see that the contrast is like, you know, all these other processes, they don't bring any results, they don't bring any success, they don't do anything good for us or anybody else if they don't have any tinge of bhakti. And bhakti itself supplies us with all auspiciousness, with all other results. And it's much easier to perform, it's much more satisfying from the beginning to the end. And so, for example, we can see how karma yoga is included in our bhakti yoga process. You know, we stand in front of the dais and just clap our hands. Our sins disappear. So, you know, people do so much charity, so much welfare work, you know, and all these things. And we just stand in front of Radha and say, Jaya Radha, Radha, and clap our hands, and, you know, get the much faster results. And, what to speak of chanting? You know, just one name of Krishna can destroy so many sins we're not even able to perform. Like Ajamil, he was calling out Narayan, and some without offenses, like almost without offenses. And he was brought back to the spiritual world and saved from that hellish condition which ordinarily would have awaited him. And so we every day, actually, we are sometimes not really aware of how auspicious the activities are we actually doing here. You know, just coming to Mangalarti, just looking at the deity, such simple things, looking at the deity is so powerful. Chanting our japa, offering some flowers to Srila Prabhupada, are such powerful processes. So we should be actually become aware. And what the verse was saying, if we become aware of that super excellence of devotional service, we can more appreciate it. And we can, as Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport, become ecstatic just by the appreciation of how powerful and how beautiful bhakti is. And if we all know familiarity breeds contempt. So, oh, I was going to say, and you're like, oh yes, have some flowers for, you know, like, oh, the deities again. Oh, I've seen that set last week, you know. So, if we are aware of how powerful and how beautiful this process is, we can get so much more benefit because, you know, we pay attention to it, we appreciate it, we are grateful to the Lord. If you're not grateful, how can we progress? If we are not grateful to Srila Prabhupada, how can we appreciate what he's done for us, and how can we, you know, stick to it? You know, if we are really grateful for something, we hold on to it like a precious jewel. If we have familiarity with something, and we kind of like, oh yeah, this is gonna, we just might chuck it out. But if we are convinced of the value of something we have, then we really protect it and hold on to it. And referring to the Gyan process as well, the Gyan process is there to destroy ignorance. So through knowledge is considered to be light and ignorance is considered to be darkness. So many quotes throughout the scriptures explain this point, how when there's light, there cannot be darkness. And when you come to Krishna, and Krishna is considered to be like light, then the darkness just cannot remain. Darkness is basically the absence of light. And so, for example, the modes of nature, which are born from the illusory energy, which are considered to be darkness to our consciousness, they vanish automatically without any great study, without any great austerities. There's quite a few very nice quotes. There's, Krishna is compared to sunshine and Maya is compared to darkness. Wherever there's sunshine, there cannot be darkness. As soon as one takes the Krishna consciousness, the darkness of illusion, the influence of the external energy, will immediately vanish. In Srimad Bhagavatam, 2nd Canto, 9th chapter, 34th verse, what appears to be truth without me is certainly my illusory energy, for nothing can exist without me. It is like a reflection of our real light and the shadows, for in the light there are neither. And then Srila Prabhupada explains in a very famous purport how the illusory energy of Krishna, Maya, she is ashamed to stand in front of Krishna. Because for us, she stands between Krishna and us. We see the illusory energy. She's actually embarrassed to be there. She wants Krishna to be standing in front of her, but it is her job. But so because it's Maya's job, she has a job. She has to bewilder the unfortunate people who don't have any purified intelligence and who just roam around in the world trying to satisfy themselves. There's another beautiful quote. One is immediately freed from the clutches of Maya if he seriously and sincerely says, my dear Lord Krishna, although I have forgotten you for so many long years in the material world, today I'm surrendering unto you. I'm your sincere and sincere servant. Please engage me in your service. So straight away, if we have that consciousness, Maya will say, all right, here he is. And will step aside. And if we see Krishna, if we are standing in the sun, Krishna is like the sun, then immediately we will see ourselves, the Lord, and everything around him. So all illusion, all darkness, which otherwise we have to cultivate by so much study of Vedanta, which in Kali Yuga we don't even have the brain for. And so automatically, just by seeing Krishna, all ignorance will dissipate. And so it's not just that the illusory energy dissipates and that the ignorance dissipates, but with that complete knowledge and that complete realization, that complete jnana and seeing of Krishna, liberation, as Bilba Mangala Thakur explains, is standing in front of him with folded hands just by performing bhakti yoga. And liberation is not just standing with folded hands in front of him. Liberation considers herself to be his maid servant. So for a devotee, liberation becomes their very obedient servant, because she comes automatically when we become devotees. So, and another aspect of this whole verse is that all our desires will be fulfilled if we just approach the Supreme Lord. Because ultimately, like in the very beginning, Srila Prabhupada was saying that the ultimate goal of all yoga processes is to know Krishna. So jnana yoga and karma yoga are performed because there's envy of the Supreme Lord. But if we want to attain the supreme goal, ultimately this envy has to be destroyed. So because there's the envy in the heart of those who are practicing other yoga systems, they do a big detour. They have to go all around Krishna to finally come on the other end to Krishna. So they have to go all the way through jnanas, with the yoga process, and finally they come to Krishna anyway, because this is the goal. So for a devotee, he hasn't to go on this big, big detour. The devotee goes straight towards Krishna. It's the ultimate shortcut. And everything is going to be supplied by the Supreme Lord. All the results we achieve through karma yoga, through jnana yoga, are automatically included. And Krishna is so kind, because we personally approach him. It is not that we're just relying on the power of our own. It's not that we rely on the power, how strong is our intelligence to discriminate, how strong is our determination to perform all the severe austerities. Krishna, actually, because he is a person, he helps us. You know, for example, for a little child, things are so difficult to achieve. But if he just goes to the father and he just asks, "Oh, daddy, can you help me with it?" The father has so much more abilities, has so much more strength, has money or whatever, and he just helps out the little child. But if the little child thinks, "Oh, I can do it all on my own," fights his way through the world. You know, first of all, it's like the jnana yogis and the karma yogis. It's very troublesome, and who knows if he's gonna have the result. So for a devotee, it's like we have our loving parent on the side who's always going to protect us and he's going to look after our best interest. So nothing can harm us, and he's going to support us in our every endeavor. And also because Krishna is very loving, he sees our heart and he sees there's impurities there, there's some material desires. And just in the way to keep us fixed in our bhakti yoga, sometimes he might even fulfill a material desire. You know, just for example, to situate us well in our devotional service. Krishna is not like a cruel university professor who gives us a test we can't possibly do, and he has pleasure of seeing us failing, like, ha ha ha, see how he's struggling and see how he can't manage. Then instead, Krishna is helping us all the way along. Sometimes we are not even aware how much help we receive. And we can become a little bit puffed up and think, "Oh, I'm, you know, doing so nicely in our Krishna consciousness." But without Krishna's help, with our Guru's help, like, where would we be? Just remember some years ago where we've been, you know? Just remember. So what we have now is because Krishna is helping us so much. We are not, like, well, I can't speak of myself. I'm not a great yogi, would be able to perform anything like Shamrita Muni. So all the credits, or whatever tiny little bit I might have achieved in my Bhakti Yoga is just because Guru and Krishna are helping me and protecting me and guiding me. So that's the divinity of the devotional service, that we actually are looked after by the Supreme Lord and by His pure representatives. And we don't have to fight our way through like that. And very important, of course, is to seek help. Like, you know, we all know that without attaining the mercy of Krishna's pure devotee, we can't progress in Bhakti Yoga. So our very process is based on the mercy of Krishna's representatives. So therefore, we should again, you know, what's it called? Familiarity breeds contempt. So it's a great offense to consider the spiritual master just an ordinary human being, but he's considered to be like a direct representative of the Lord. So we should always remember that the spiritual master is the one who brings us closer to the Lord, which on our own we would not be able to perform. And therefore we should, you know, be very respectful and make as the idealist the instructions of the spiritual master our life and soul, and serve him in that way as an obedient servant. And by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, we will achieve that desired goal, which is explained as being the goal of all the different yoga processes. So that is Krishna Bhakti. Okay, I think that's all I want to say. If any questions or comments or corrections?
You mentioned that Bhakti is like the yeast in the bread to make it rise. So, what is that characteristic that makes the performance of yoga or even dhyana successful? What is the characteristic of bhakti that those other processes depend upon?
As far as I know, if we approach karma or yoga, jnana, it's based on the subtle body. Well, like yoga also on the gross body. So it's based on the subtle body, and without Krishna's support, we can't rise to spirituality because our mind is entrapped in these modes. So as far as I know, you can't, like, you know, this is an example, you can't untie yourself. Like, you know, somebody who is himself tied with ropes can't untie another person who's tied with ropes. So unless we are, like, if we are conditioned, we can't possibly can uncondition ourselves. So there's always this element of mercy we have to invoke, as far as I understand. Would be like the reciprocation of the Lord.
Like to be ingredient of bhakti that's essential. What's the essential ingredient of bhakti that makes these other processes successful in relation to what you just said?
The mercy of the Lord, which the would that we approach the Lord to lift us out of the material entanglement. Because this is the other element which has been added to our own endeavors.
So how does that relate to, say, if I'm a jnani, I have to perform some aspect of bhakti for my jnani to be successful, So how does the mercy of the Lord and the mercy of the Lord relate to that and to my performance of bhakti, even though I'm a jnani?
Well, that you get the, actually the results, that you actually get realizations. Because, like, I'm sure, like, everyone had that realization. We study something and we think we've understood. And then we come to a point where we actually realize what we've studied and we understand that we actually hadn't understood anything before. So it gives the realization.
So you're saying that we depend on Krishna's mercy for the success of anything.
Well, on a sort of supplication, I suppose.
Yeah,
like mercy, mercy is.
My question is, what is the supreme in bhakti that the other processes depend upon? We could say that we all depend on Krishna's mercy ultimately. But how does, what I'm curious about is, what is the essential, or what are the ingredients of bhakti that these other processes require in order for them to be successful? Just like,
I think I know what you mean.
You don't have any yeast in the bread, then you've got a flat piece of, you know, baked flour and water.
Well, there's always ulterior motives in the other yoga processes which are not there in bhakti yoga. For example, there's the selfishness which we want to attain liberation. We want to be free from the conditioning. So unless we come to a platform where we don't lose that ego or that desire for, like, our selfish goal, we can't be completely liberated.
But, Prabhupada does say this, he says, the other processes are dependent on bhakti to be successful. So, I'm curious to know, what is it within bhakti that makes them successful? And what elements of bhakti do they contain? So if you're a jnani, how does it work?
Love and service, you refer to love and service, then it's your rubies, then how can you still do that?
They have to do some part of bhakti. It has to be something of bhakti that they do that makes the jnana successful.
Say, for example, the Srimad Bhagavatam, which has the portion of bhakti, and they read about Vishnu and Krishna, so they're making some progress in devotional service. That is an item of bhakti.
Yeah, they surrender to a guru, for example, they hear from the guru. They may even worship the deity, they might worship their guru.
Well,
there are aspects of bhakti.
They go to the performing yoga, the chanting names of Vishnu, the performing the sacrifice.
What about the chanting name of Shiva? Okay. They still chant the sacrifice
of Om. Chanting Om, sorry.
Well, I've read that even in the Brahman realization, even if you emerge already, there still can be traces of false ego, even at that stage, and read in one of the purports from Srila Prabhupada. So apparently there's some impurities, which, like, later on Srila Prabhupada said, if, like, the great yogis fall down, they go back to philanthropic activities. So there's still something which hasn't been purified. And at the other time also there's this aspect of ananda, of bliss, which will fix us in our position. So even we might come to a very high level, but we don't get that satisfaction out of it. And that might keep us on also like material desires if we don't get that satisfaction.
In order to get to that Brahman realization, in order to
achieve
that amount
of bhakti,
Prabhupada indicates that you have to perform some aspects of bhakti yoga to get to that point.
Yeah. Well,
so I think, what are the essential ingredients? And I think my mind is at least uncovered some. You know, in order to get to that point, you have to learn from the guru, you have to follow his instruction. That's there's elements of bhakti in those activities.
Yeah.
Even though the goal is, you know, not necessarily the realization of pure devotional service.
As I read in the beginning, that even in the yama niyama process of the Ashtanga Yoga, studies of the shastras and chanting of mantras, so all these things they are included, or like one of the other aspects was to surrender oneself to God.
Yeah.
So that's, it's like all it's penetrating the whole process, basically, is aspects of bhakti.
Yes.
Are you talking about sincerity? Sincere surrender?
Not necessarily, because you can be sincere, you know. Why not? You have to be sincere to be a successful bhakti yogi. And say, for example, Vikashura, you know, he was sincerely worshipping Lord Shiva by cutting off his flesh. That aspect of sincerity is required in bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
It was also, you know, helping there. So in my sense, almost all endeavors that are successful have some elements of bhakti in them. Because bhakti almost permeates everything. If you look at the totality of devotional service and all of the activities in devotional service that we follow, there's so much of what we do in everything that happens in our place. So that's how Prabhupada comes. Because I often wonder, what does Prabhupada mean? You know, that has to be elements of bhakti in order for it to be successful.
Sincere,
So you have to be saying they have to have some elements of the nine items of personal service.
I have heard one question also. How can you be between Mayavadi and impersonalist?
What is that?
Mayavadi and impersonalist. What is the difference between the two?
Well, one is
impersonalist and Mayavadi.
Quite a while ago, there. The Mayavadi thinks that everything is, as far as I know, the Mayavadi thinks that everything is illusion.
Impersonalists want to merge in Krishna, isn't it?
Sorry?
Impersonalists want to merge.
Yeah, that everything is ultimately.
You are God, I am God, everybody is God.
Yeah. So that ultimately we are all this one supreme God. And the Mayavadi thinks that everything material is illusion.
They have no love, no sincerity.
You teach them, but I don't remember who you teach. Is anything else? Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Jai.